Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 24th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, Jeffrey Staley begins his series of Bible studies on Luke Acts entitled A Spirit-Born Community, Jesus, the Disciples, and Us in Luke Acts. Today's session is number one and is titled Divine Altercations, Luke 1, 1-25, and Acts 1, 1-26. Let's listen in.
Good morning. It's good to be here with you. My name is Jeff Staley, and for this week, I'm doing the Bible studies, and I will be here actually next week and the week following. So that's why I have chosen the title for this week, A Spirit-Born Community, Jesus, the Disciples, and Us in Luke Acts. Even though we won't be dealing much with Acts this week, I have put up on the board a text from Acts, because you might want to explore these at your own leisure. There's some interesting comparisons and contrasts when you read Luke and Acts kind of at the same time. So I've called the session today Divine Altercations, and that's altercations with no E. Okay, I enjoy puns because they can take you in all kinds of directions. And what happens in this particular story is something happens at an altar, and so I thought that might be appropriate. Divine Altercations, Luke 1, 1-25, and in parentheses, Acts 1, 1-11. I've been up here at Holden once before in 1991 when I was doing Bible studies. I brought my son, who was 6 at the time, and we had a wonderful 2 weeks up here. And this is my second time back. I'm very happy to be here. This time I brought my daughter along as well, who is 7.5, and my son again, who's now 11. Still haven't quite talked my wife into coming up here. She hears about volunteering and says, I try and tell her it's not much volunteering, but I think we almost got her this time. I think next time we will. Last week she said, you know, I could have only come for a week. I said, yeah, you didn't have to come for all 3 weeks.
She can still come. Send her a postcard.
Send her a postcard. Okay, maybe I will. I sent her a postcard. It'll go out today. Except I should have put on it, yeah. Please come. We need you.
She wanted to be needed. She wanted to be needed.
Miss you. Okay. Miss it. That's true. Okay. We're studying then Luke Acts, and next week actually I'm doing a study in the Gospel of John, an autobiography, which is one of my real interests. I have a book that is actually over at the bookstore called Reading with a Passion, Rhetoric, Autobiography, and the American West in the Gospel of John. The title is supposed to catch your attention. And you'll see as we go through these studies, I think, maybe how the American West, maybe it'll even come into Luke, I don't know. But it did apply, actually, eventually to the Gospel of John. So I will, because of my interest in autobiography, I will often begin with a story from my life to help orient us to the Gospel of Luke. I also have some questions up here that I hope in the last 15 minutes we can spend some time in groups of 4 to 6 talking about these questions, but I put them up there now so that you might think about them, and I'll try and read them. The first one is, if you had to choose a beginning of your spiritual biography, where would you begin it? When would it begin? Really, with whom would it begin? And what would the setting of that story be, or that beginning? And then a second question, that's all one question. You know, I'm a professor, so we ask these questions that we say is only one, but it's actually five or six. From your own experience, what would you name as a mark or marks of the Spirit? Are there any clues in this text, that is the one I will be reading, are there any clues in this text as to what those marks might be? So this will give us some time to reflect, and then, of course, in light of the scripture. A week ago Saturday, I was in Phoenix, Arizona, which is a little bit different than Holden Village in climate and in the general tenor of the area. My father turned 70 on Father's Day, and four of my siblings, counting me, five out of the six children of my father, were there to help him celebrate his birthday and Father's Day. Although my father is relatively active and in good health, to us, his children, he seems to have given up on living. He has seemed to be in a state of depression for over 2 years now, and actually my youngest brother and I, at the end, after the celebration, were asking ourselves how much longer we thought he was going to live, which is not normally the kind of question you ask of somebody who is 70 years old and in good health today. He seems to have given up on living. He seemed to have been stated, like I said, a state of depression for over 2 years. He's married to a woman whom he seems to like less and less with each passing year. Although my father, not very talkative, wouldn't say that. It seems our perspective. My mother died in 1984, and he remarried in 1986. He's lived in a big city, that is Phoenix, since 1990, after having lived the prior 32 years on an isolated mission compound on the Navajo Indian Reservation in northeastern Arizona, which is where I grew up. He wonders audibly whether the mission school he nurtured for more than 30 years will survive into the 21st century, since he's left. It's gone slowly downhill in enrollment, with more and more difficulty getting teachers. He seems to have lost his interest in life, in those things that once excited him: reading, traveling, his family. Although still physically active, his spirit appears to be sputtering out. There is little spark in his smile, and there's no twinkle in his eye. So what is, quote, the spirit, unquote, that Holden Village has been speaking about and about which we will be hearing this week and in the weeks ahead? Where is this spirit to be found, and what are the evidences of it? Is the divine spirit like the human spirit? Like my father's spirit, something that can be had and something that can be lost, something that dies and something that can be revived? What are the signs of its presence and the marks of its absence? Who is authorized to speak in its power and encourage it in others? These are some of the questions I'd like to explore during this week of Bible studies. Luke, I believe, has his own particular perspective on these questions: the marks of the Spirit, the evidence of the Spirit, who is authorized to speak for the Spirit, and to encourage it in others. If you don't like Luke's point of view, be happy that it's not the only perspective within the New Testament. There are other points of view, and particularly, I think, in the sermon last night, we heard some of Paul's perspective on the Spirit. And Paul's view of the Spirit is quite a bit different, actually, than the view we find in Luke and Acts. But so we might find room to agree with elements in Luke's perspective on the Spirit, and you might find yourself at times saying, well, I'm not sure. You know, maybe you might say, I like Paul or some other perspective, perhaps the Gospel of John, which is different as well. But this will give us some room, I think, to explore the elements of the Spirit and Luke's point of view. As with the story of my father, the author of Luke Acts begins the story of Jesus with an old man. His name is Zechariah. I think the name is somewhat ironic. The name means God remembers. And his wife, Elizabeth. And Elizabeth's name, perhaps also ironic, means my God is the one by whom to swear. Zechariah and Elizabeth have lived long enough to see many of their hopes and dreams crushed.
Is that the Spirit?
I may be, I know. The lights.
I'm trying to turn these lights on.
Oh, okay. Zechariah and Elizabeth have wanted a child, and that's what the initial story in Luke is about. In that culture, who doesn't want a child? Children are your security in your old age. You raised your children to not to be independent of you, but in a sense to be close to you and to care for you when you got old. There's no social security system. It's a modern invention for in our modern culture. When children move away, we shoo them out of the nest and then wonder where they've gone later on. But in ancient biblical culture, or the ancient Mediterranean culture, one reason for having children was to have somebody to care for you when you got old. Another thing, of course, an important element, particularly in a patriarchal culture like that of the Bible, children, not any children, male children, a male child was the woman's security in her husband's family. The woman, when she married into her husband's family, it was patriarchal and patrilinear and patrilocal. If you know anything about anthropology, patrilinear means that the family inheritance passes through the male line. Patrilocal, anyone know that? That's a little bit. When the woman married, she went and lived with her husband's family. There's lots of other options. The Navajo culture where I grew up was matrilinear and matrilocal. That is, when a man got married, he went and lived, not so much anymore, but even when I was a kid, he would go and live with his wife's family. But not so in biblical culture. And so when a woman got married, she went and lived with her husband's family. And she had no voice in that community and no place really in that family until she bore a male heir. Good example of the story, which this story in Luke kind of parallels, is that of Abraham and Sarah, who have no child. Sarah gives her servant to Hagar to Abraham, and Abraham has a child, Ishmael, through this woman, Hagar. But eventually, Sarah does also conceive and bears a son. And immediately in the story, anyway, he's actually, Ishmael is 12 years old, and I think, if I remember rightly, Isaac has just been weaned. She makes sure that Ishmael and Hagar are kicked out of the family. Why? Because she wants to make sure that it's her son that is the inheritor and not the son of her husband by Hagar. So it's very important that a woman, this is Sarah's claim on that her husband's family, because she's now born a son. So this family, Elizabeth, has no firm place in Zechariah's family. She has no son. And of course, it's always the woman's problem in a patriarchal culture. That is, why didn't they have a child? Because Elizabeth was barren. I mean, we don't know anything about, sperm counts in that culture, whether, who knows, maybe that was the problem, but no, it's, she is barren, and that's the problem, it's her problem. And now it seems to be too late for children. Well, I'm fascinated by beginnings and stories. In the continuum or cycle of life history, why do we choose to begin a story of a person or a family or a nation where we do? Why does this story begin where it does? The story, if we know the gospel, is not about Zechariah. It's not about Elizabeth. And it's really not about their son, John. The story is going to go off in a much different direction. As we follow the story at the beginning, we find out quite quickly when I read through it that Zechariah is a priest. The story is not about priests. As a matter of fact, most of the priests, other than Zechariah, don't look too good in the story. John the Baptist, who certainly had all the evidence, the right lineage to be a priest, never becomes a priest. So the story goes off in a much different direction than the opening scene. And that's one of the fun things to ask them. Why start the story where it does if that's not the way it's going to go? But another reason for having a child, of course, beyond the fact of the woman now gains a place of status in her husband's family, another reason is to have someone to take care of you in your old age. Another reason, of course, is to have somebody who remembers you when you are gone. And I think, in a way, there's still that even today, and the very human natural urge to have a child, some of that is to see your name carrying on. I'm not a grandfather yet, but I have heard that this is true, one of the really beautiful things about having grandchildren is to see the generations and say, wow, there's some bit of me somehow going beyond not just my children, but now in the life of my grandchildren. I saw a video a few weeks ago from a conference that was held at the University of Oregon on education after the Holocaust. And one of the lecturers told a story about a Holocaust survivor. And the survivor, a young girl at 15, was waiting for a train. And her family and friends were being herded on into these cattle cars. And she had this horrible feeling that this might be the end. She might never come back. And her fear at 15 wasn't so much of dying. Her fear, she said, was that nobody would remember that she had lived. At 15 years old, everybody around her, she had this feeling, was going to disappear. And there was this horrible feeling at 15 that she would have lived and nobody in the world would ever have known that she existed. And so very quickly, before she got on the train, she scrawled in graffiti on the wall, "Hannah lived," and wrote a date and wrote the date of her birth. She was one of the lucky ones who did survive. But how many, you think back of those people who lived and nobody today knows that they ever lived. I think the name God, Zechariah, God remembers, This is part of Zechariah and Elizabeth's fear and anxiety. Natural. Will anybody remember? God will remember. But yeah, I want some kind of human evidence too, that there was somebody, that I was here. So that's the way this story begins. And I'm fascinated, as I say, by these beginnings. I could spend the whole time, actually, I think, this week simply talking about Luke 1 and 2 in the beginnings, but we're going to go beyond that. If you think about the history of the United States and where we choose our beginnings when we talk about American history, when I was a kid, I think it's a little bit different now, we began with Plymouth Rock, 1620, Mayflower Compact. You know, that's where American history, history of the United States begins. But I grew up in the Southwest, in Arizona, went to high school in New Mexico. There was a revolution 100 years almost before the American, the quote, American Revolution, a battle for independence in the Southwest. That was the Taos Rebellion that liberated for about a generation a whole list of Native American cities from the Spaniards. But that's not usually part of what we learn as the American Revolution or the battle for independence. We have another name, another war, another era for that. You know, where do we begin American history? Why is it with Plymouth Rock? Well, if you happen to grow up in the southern states, there's a number of eastern seaboard settlements that predate, of course, Plymouth Rock. One of the most important one, of course, Jamestown. Why isn't Jamestown the one? Well, I think part of it, I mean, I don't know my American history as well as I should, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if part of it is because what state is it in? Who won the Civil War? You know, you don't begin with Jamestown for a northern federal government that won the Civil War. You don't start with a village in Virginia, which was one of the most important colonies or states to secede from the Union. No, you start with somewhere in New England.
Just for the record, yeah. My history started with Jamestown.
Oh, yours did. Okay. Mine, actually, I do have blood that goes back to the, not to Jamestown, but to Plymouth. So, on my mother's side. But it is interesting, you know, why not start with the Southwest the Southeast rather than the Northeast? There's lots of places one can begin the history. And I think it tells us more about ourselves, really, and where we are and who we are today rather than real beginnings. In the same way, if you look at the Gospels, every Gospel starts differently. There's four of them, and not one of them starts in the same place. Mark, which is probably the earliest and for most modern readers, starts in perhaps the strangest place with John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness, a baptism of repentance. Nothing about the early life of Jesus or the birth of Jesus. Whereas Matthew and Luke both begin, Matthew begins with a genealogy and then begins with the disconcerting story of Joseph, who discovers the girl he's engaged to or betrothed to is pregnant, and the one thing that Joseph knows is that he's not the father. A rather strange and difficult beginning to the story. Of course, he has the advantage of having an angel who appears to him in a dream and says, don't be afraid to take this girl to be your wife, because what the child conceived is not conceived by human, but by God. But this story in Luke begins before that. with people who seem totally unrelated. And we find out, of course, that Elizabeth is actually a cousin, whatever that means, of Mary. But initially, there's no clue that Zechariah and Elizabeth are any relation to Jesus, who's going to be the hero of the story. And then, of course, John, what can you do after you can't have a gospel after John, a story that begins in the beginning? You know, what do you... there's nothing to say after that, and so we don't have any other gospels. Well, there are other gospels, but they didn't make it into the New Testament. Where do you go? Somebody's got to push it back to the very beginning. Each gospel starts in a different place, and I think it's fun to ask, why does the story begin there? In the same way, to reflect on our own lives, where do we begin the story of our faith journey or our own spiritual biography? Well, let me read through then the first 25 verses of this chapter and then make a few remarks about it. And then we will break up into groups of 4 to 6 and spend a little bit of time talking about these questions and then coming back together at the end and exploring some of the things that we've come up with. The beginning of Luke's gospel. Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. In the days of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah, who belonged to the priestly order of Abijah. His wife was a descendant of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Both of them were righteous before God, living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord. But they had no children, because Elizabeth was barren, and both were getting on in years. Once, when he was serving as priest before God in his section on duty, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and offer incense. Now at the time of the incense offering, the whole assembly of the people was praying outside. Then there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was terrified and fear overwhelmed him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John. You will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He must never drink wine or strong drink. Even before his birth, he will be filled with the Holy Spirit. He will turn many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God. And with the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah said to the angel, "How will I know that this is so? For I'm an old man and my wife is getting on in years." The angel replied, "I'm Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I've been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. But now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will become mute, unable to speak until the day these things occur." Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondering at his delay in the sanctuary. When he did come out, he could not speak to them, and they realized that he had seen a vision in the sanctuary. He kept motioning to them and remained unable to speak. When his time of service was ended, he went to his home. After those days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and for 5 months she remained in seclusion. She said, "This is what the Lord has done for me when he looked favorably on me and took away the disgrace I have endured among my people." Tomorrow we'll look at the Annunciation to Mary. Well, this gospel begins with a very sophisticated sounding prologue. The first 4 verses of Luke are written in perhaps the best Greek in the New Testament, outside of the book of Hebrews. This is all one sentence, And then the story, actually from verse 5 on, sounds very much like the Old Testament. The Old Testament, which was translated from Hebrew into Greek, sounds very much like Luke chapter 1, verse 5, on through chapter 3. You think you're reading something very different than the prologue. The prologue itself is a bit disconcerting if you read it carefully and think about the New Testament. Because this author says at the beginning that he has studied things carefully, has read other documents and kind of investigated things, and is going to write an orderly account. Now, most scholars think that we have at least one of the sources that Luke used in writing his gospel. Anyone know what that source was?
Mark.
Most likely Mark. Now, the you read this prologue, it sounds like the author of Luke is trying to displace, among other things, at least displace Mark. He's saying, you know, he's read other accounts and certainly uses Mark. Then it sounds like one of the things that Luke is intending to do is to displace Mark. And the interesting thing is, in the history of the church anyway, that church has decided, well, that may be your intention, Luke, but we like Mark too. And Mark is not excluded from the New Testament, even though Luke in many ways seems to intend to displace that. Now, according to scholars, there is at least one other source that most likely Luke used, and this is a source that is called, for lack of a better term, anyone know what that is? A source of Q, right, where Luke and Matthew have a source in common. Best example of this is the Lord's Prayer, which is found in Matthew and Luke and is not found in the Gospel of Mark. So where you have Matthew and Luke having material that's not found in Mark, generally that is called Q, which is short for initial for the German Quelle, which means source. Sometimes in English it's called the sayings source because it's made up only of sayings. Now, the interesting thing there is that we don't have a gospel called the sayings gospel, even though scholars recently have tried to reconstruct it, and you can go into a big religious bookstore and sometimes find on the shelf even a commentary on Q, or the sayings gospel, now that scholars have tried to reconstruct what this might have been back behind Luke and Mark, Matthew. The interesting thing is that Luke probably used at least Mark and at least Q, and succeeded in one. That is, if Q really existed, Matthew and Luke succeeded in silencing Q. Q no longer exists. Both Matthew and Luke used Mark, but for some peculiar reason, were not able to silence the voice of Mark, for whatever reason. And you have to read, we're not studying Mark this week, you have to come back some other time when somebody's doing Mark to figure out why, for whatever reason, the church said, no, we like what you're doing, but we like Mark too. We're not going to let you silence Mark. But what we'll see, actually, I hope, as we go through Luke, some of the differences between Mark and Luke that might tell us perhaps why Mark was not silenced as well. But anyway, that's the beginning, kind of a bit disconcerting. But after that, actually, everything is fine and dandy. I mean, you couldn't begin the story better than the way Luke begins it. You have a priestly family. I mean, if you're a Jew, where else to start the story but with the elite, the priests, who were the elite in that culture. And not only with a family, a priestly family, this man, Zechariah, has married well and properly. He's married a daughter that is descended from a priestly family, and he is also serving in the temple, which is the proper duty of a priest. So it's got the perfect characters to begin a story for the Jewish people, priestly family. It's got the proper place, the temple. It's got the proper time, the hour, an hour of sacrifice. And the interesting thing is, for this particular person, Zechariah, it may be the only time in his life that he actually serves in the temple. It fell to him by lot. And actually, if you were to read, a little bit beyond in the book of Acts, you discover something else falls to somebody by lot, by fall of the dice, in a way. But this might be the only time in the life of this priest that he ever serves inside the holy sanctuary. Now, he may have served many times in some menial tasks outside, but perhaps only once in his lifetime would the lot fall to him to actually go into the Holy of Holies. Now, the other important thing is that you can only do that if you yourself have followed all the purity restrictions. So we don't know if Zechariah was a Sadducee or not. Most likely he probably was. If he were a Sadducee, the Sadducees believed that you ought to follow the priestly restrictions on purity only when you are actually on service in the temple. So at least that is, it wasn't always necessary, unlike the Pharisees who believed you always should practice the purity restrictions. The Sadducees were actually, in this respect, sounded more liberal, that you only had to practice the purity laws in the book of Leviticus when you were serving in the temple. The rest of the time, the purity restrictions didn't hold. So we know that at least for this time, when Zechariah is in the temple, he has followed the purity restrictions of the book of Leviticus to a T. Otherwise, he couldn't be in there. He's got to be the perfect specimen for his age of a human, according to Jewish standards, to be a priest, no blemishes, no open wounds or sores or anything like that. He is absolutely pure and holy according to the Levitical laws. He's in the right place. He's the right kind of person at the right kind of place at the right kind of time. The interesting thing is, of course, in one respect, is that things don't happen the way that they're supposed to. Suddenly, while he's doing everything properly, something strange happens. He has this divine altercation, one might say, that is, an angel appears to him and says, don't be afraid, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John. Now, that seems like a very personal kind of prayer. I mean, this is, he's in there in the temple praying on behalf of the nation, you know, and the angel comes and says, your particular prayer is going to be answered. Your personal desire, your personal hope and dream is going to be fulfilled. You're going to have a child. But if you read on, of course, you realize that it may be his personal desire, but the person who is born, John, has a much broader role than just being his father's son. He is going to turn the hearts of many toward God. So it is, in a sense, a national prayer that is being answered, even though it's a very personal yearning on the part of Zechariah and Elizabeth. So this prayer then is going to be answered. And the story, I think, then shows that it's not going to really be a story about priests. We have some clues, anyway, that the story is not going to be about a priestly family. All the action is not going to happen in a temple. The whole focus of the story is not going to be on proper sacrifice or whatever. But the question, I think, that is going to be answered in the process of the book is one about a God who responds to promises and prayers in God's own choosing, in God's own timing, and in God's own place. The next story is really a story that takes place in a much, we might say, improper setting in many ways. If the first Annunciation comes to a man, which is also very proper in a patriarchal culture, the next one comes to a young girl, which we would assume generally is not the proper order, not the proper place, not in Jerusalem, somewhere else. We don't know even what time it takes place. It doesn't matter. So the next story will be quite a bit different. So it's about a God who responds to promises, a God who responds to prayers in spite or regardless of propriety. The question will be, how does God respond, and when does God respond? And I think those will address this question or relate to the question of then how we see and respond to the Spirit of God in the life of the world today, in our own personal lives too, as we look at how, in spite of the propriety of everything, God kind of comes in by surprise in various places and in various ways. Now, the questions that I want to have us reflect on, I've written up there, and what I'd like you to do is to break up into groups of four or six and think about these. We'll spend come back in about with 5 minutes to spare, or a little bit more, and share the findings of these, and particularly then ask the question related to the last one. But first, the first question, if you had to choose a beginning of your spiritual, or for your spiritual biography, where would you begin it? With whom would you begin it? When would that story begin? And what would the setting of that story be? And then secondly, from your own experience, what would you name as, quote, marks of the Spirit, unquote? And then, since this is a Bible study, appropriately, are there any clues in this text as to what those marks of the Spirit might be? I think there are some in here. So this is all, of course, this is only two questions, believe it or not. So take some time, find a group of four to six people around you, introduce yourself briefly, who you are, and then address these questions. So we will turn off the tape now for a few minutes. I will remind us when to turn it back on at this time. And for the final, then, what I have 6 minutes, what I'd like to ask is just people respond, you know, a few people respond to the first question and then respond to the second one and see how where we go with it. So the first one again, if you had to choose a beginning for your spiritual biography, where would you begin it? Ways to think with, you know, when would that begin, with whom in the setting. Any common things come up in your particular group, or was there quite a bit of diversity?
Yeah. Well, Sunday school. Sunday school teachers.
Okay, Sunday school teachers.
In common with the four of us.
Would that come up in any other groups? Sunday school teachers that had an influence and might be the beginning point? And somebody up here was about to say something else?
8 years old. About 8 years old, we were all.
About in the whole group, about 8 years old? Interesting. What about age? Did that come up in any other group? A common age?
Fifth grade.
Fifth grade. Okay, eighth grade.
Young to fifth grade.
Okay. Any particular reason why it could be around that age? Eight? And is it because of particular things that happen in a religious setting, or you think it might be, I mean, personality development, or
significant other adults in our lives?
Significant other adults.
But I think you're open to them when you're younger than when you get older.
Okay.
I think your rationalism hasn't set in so firmly yet.
Okay. Yeah, my daughter is seven. She's seven and a half, and I was 7.5 years old when we moved to the Navajo Reservation. So I mean, this is. Been a really special year for me, anyway, with my daughter, because I remember so much that important move in my life. And it's, you know, seven, eight, I think, are really a fun age.
You're a sponge. You're soaking everything, and you can read fairly well.
Yeah,
so
right.
All that together.
Yeah. Okay.
There was a fair amount of conversation in our group about grandmothers.
Grandmothers. Okay. That come up in other groups? Grandparents, grandmothers up here? Yeah. As positive spiritual influence beginning. Now, you know, that's as our culture moves further and further away from parents and grandparents, that probably we'll lose a lot of that. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know, does this cross generations here? I mean, generations, what kinds of people talked about their grandparents? I mean, age groups, mainly my age, 40 and above, or younger than 40? Anyone younger than 40 had strong...
Old and
or was it just old people like me? I didn't live close to my grandparents, but if you grew up in a rural area, or maybe in some cities, it still happens. Okay, so grandparents, in a sense, perhaps, like this...
We were talking about, as it came out, there were a variety of beginning ages, but when I think about it, the common denominator in each case, we were set down into a community of believers.
Okay, a community of believers. Okay.
A congregation, uh-huh. A prayer group, my college experience, it was always a community of believers.
So, not individual on your own, but the community was really important. It's interesting. Speaking of the second question, one of the things that I noted is for in John the Baptist is that, I mean, now it's going to be weird when you actually read about John the Baptist, but he's a community builder. I mean, he will turn many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God with a spirit. He'll turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of righteousness. I mean, he has family values, right? Now, what's interesting, I mean, this in a sense, at the beginning sounds like, you know, a real mark of the Spirit, that is the role of community building. But it's interesting when you get to Jesus, and some of the sayings of Jesus, which is not about bringing families together, but...
Living apart.
Yeah, now, so there's the fun thing, I think, in this gospel, and why you ask these marks of the Spirit, or, you know, there seems to be some... There will seem to be some things that are in clear tension. And when you hear, you know, good old John preach, I mean, hey, it doesn't sound really like community building. When he talks about, you know, your parents are snakes, I mean, oh, okay, you brood of vipers. But anyway, I think, yeah, community is something that is going to be a question I really want to pursue through here, because I think that's certainly an issue with Holy Jews. You know, the Spirit in community, how is that evident? It might be evident in sometimes conflicting ways, but oh, we have 4 or 5 minutes. It's supposed to be 5 minute bell, right? A couple more. I have 2 minutes left? Oh, good. Okay, because I think I am supposed to quit right at 10. Any other things that came up before we move to this, the second question, marks of the Spirit?
Baptism.
Baptism as a...
As,
beginning point?
Yeah.
And of course, I think the question, there's a clear connection between probably beginning points and what we see as marks of the Spirit, too, probably. Or it could be.
How old were you when you were baptized?
I was a month old.
A month old.
How did you know then?
I didn't know that. It's just where I am now. I look back as that is the point at which the Spirit really entered me. And so the times in my adult life when I was searching or angry or questioning, that's a Spirit that refused to leave because I was marked with that cross so early. And so every time I wanted to run, I was not able to run because the Spirit just kept coming back and grabbed me home.
Okay. I think, even though I must confess I am not Lutheran, but what I remember of one of Luther's famous remarks wasn't remember your baptism, something to that effect. And I think that's, yeah. I was 7 when I was baptized. Actually, the what makes it memorable, it was the first Sunday on the Navajo reservation that I was baptized, which kind of is interesting. So any other marks of the Spirit? Baptism as both as a beginning point and also as a mark. Yeah.
Well, I'm one of these old-fashioned 40-year-old people here, but my confirmation with the pastor with their nylon vestments.
Oh, really?
They were like angels, you know.
It's probably summertime, too, with nylon, right?
No, October.
Oh, okay. So it could be...
Reformation Sunday.
Oh, okay.
Now, come on. This is good.
Oh, good. Right.
But I remember that as a very, very high point.
Okay. I heard somebody talk about death. I mean, not as kind of a beginning point, rather than, which reminded me of the sermon last night, which I thought was wonderful, but... did anyone else talk about death as kind of a death of somebody they loved or someone close to them as a beginning point of their spiritual journey or
serious illness?
Serious illness of a parent, okay. Which is both, you know, ending and beginning, right? Important. Any other marks besides for the last 30 seconds? It's certainly something then to think about, and we'll reflect on this more. The thing that I think to keep in mind is, as we go through Luke, we're going to see some real tensions, which I think will be a good avenue for the discussion as we go on. Well, thank you for coming, and I hope to see you tomorrow.